I'm Dan Meisner, and this is Work in Progress, a show about the meaning and identity we find in work. From Slack. This week, peace, love, music, drugs, and counterculture. We have two stories that begin at a very special time and place, San Francisco in the 1960s. And we start in style.
I come down here, and there's all these people on the street, and they're wearing vintage clothing. Wall-to-wall people on the sidewalk, most of them barefoot. Me and a 30s teddy with an embroidered shawl on. I mean, it was warm. People were loving towards each other. The music was over the top. I mean, just, it was free in the park. I went to the BN, and Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg were there. It was just absolutely fabulous.
It was 1967. The summer of love, and hippie counterculture was at its peak in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. For the first time in her young life, 17-year-old Cicely Hansen felt like she'd arrived.
Oh, kindred spirits. I finished high school in 3 months and zoomed back. I didn't even tell my dad. I didn't want him to come get me. They hadn't turned 18 yet.
Cicely couldn't wait to move from the suburb where she'd grown up to a city full of kindred spirits. Her home life was strained by her mother's drinking problems, and the kids at school just didn't get her.
I'm wearing vintage clothing to high school, and this is in the mid-60s. Nobody wore vintage. I mean, the boys were wearing Brooks Brothers and Madras clothing, and the girls were just absolutely not wearing that. So I was definitely a freak. I just felt like an alien.
But Cicely wouldn't want it any other way. Vintage clothing brought magic to Cicely's life ever since the age of 5. That's when her grandmother, also named Cicely, came to live with the family during a very dark time.
In 1954, unfortunately, my mom was hit by a drunk driver. And my sister was thrown, she was only 3 weeks old, up into the dashboard. And so my sister became a vegetable and blind. And just, my mother went into a depression that was just so horrific. And my poor father, he's in the Navy, gone half the time. So he also got a hold of her mother and said, please come down. I remember it like it was yesterday.
Grandmother Cicely was a former fashion model in the 1920s, and she came to the rescue with a suitcase full of vintage clothes.
Back then, on television was Howdy Doody and Rin Tin Tin and classic movies. So my grandmother made a game out of it. And when the movies were showing, if it was 1930s, then we would dress 1930s. And if it was 1940s, and in the 50s, these are what the classic movies were about, unless they were silent. So we'd go to the church rummage sales because you could buy a bias cut dress for a quarter. And I remember chasing her down the walkway at the church rummage sale and saying, Grandma, Carol Lombard, bias cut. Cut 25 cents. I gotta have it. I remember that vividly. And her saying, for 25 cents, yes, we can handle that. So we're buying these clothes. We're doing this little game. She's, it's cheering my mom up. And it became a lifelong hobby and passion.
Cicely brought that passion and her personal collection of vintage clothing to San Francisco, where she started to forge a career from her closet.
We found the storefront with an apartment. It was the only place we could afford. So we rented that. We put the stuff in the window. We put big curtains. We're getting knocks on the door. Are you selling that? Are you doing this? And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm a vintage clothing dealer. Obviously, that is my calling.
Years went by, and Cicely's career in vintage thrived. From her first shop, she moved on and opened other vintage clothing stores, as well as ventures in interior design and antiques. She had children and several exciting romances, moving from city to city. And then, at the age of 52, she found herself moving again, back to her parents' house.
I got wind that my mom was really sick, and we had not had a good relationship. Remember, when I left, she was being really drunk and really mean. But by then, I'd really grown up, and I'd had children, and I could see what had happened to her. And I thought, I'm going back home and take care of my mother.
But she would only do so under one condition.
And I said, okay, listen, you can either have a life, or I can lock you in the closet and throw food over the thing. But if you choose the life thing, you're going to have to go to rehab.
Her mom eventually agreed and started the process of getting sober.
Pretty soon I had this force to be, reckoned with mother. And we opened up a little antique shop together in Moss Landing. And we were doing all this stuff. And it wasn't perfect, but, you know, we were having a life.
But then, tragedy struck. Cicely's father was diagnosed with terminal cancer.
I started rocking him and playing Frank Sinatra. I said, "You are a brave guy, let go." And he died in my arms a few hours later.
Weeks later, the grief of his death caused her mom to tailspin back into addiction.
Because we had a deal, and she broke the deal. And I was watching a movie, classic movie, of course, and I heard some thud in her, because I'd put her in her bed. And I heard thud, she'd rolling out of the bed. And so I took her and I said, "What's wrong?" She goes, "I have to go to the bathroom." And I took her into the bathroom and she went into convulsions. And she ended up passing away the next morning. And I was so depressed because I had lost both my parents in 10 weeks.
Cicely was devastated. She no longer had any interest in running the antique store she and her mother had started. It was just too painful. What would she do next? She felt lost.
My girlfriend called me up and she said, "You know what? I think you need to come up to San Francisco." I said, "That's where I was happiest, in the Hague." And we drove up and down the street and I found a for rent sign and I was so broke I had to sleep on the floor.
Are you?
Good. Are you going to need to try anything on? Okay, I ironed this one. Put it on the back of the door.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I restored these hats, and I'm very proud of it. I mean, look at them. They're all so distinctly different. I mean, and sometimes they're squished, and we were able to bring them back. But I mean, look at how many I have, because they're just these little mini sculptures. I mean, look at
this. Cicely was back in the zone. She opened Decades of Fashion, a vintage shop right on the street that started the Summer of Love, iconic Haight Street.
I can stay here all day. I like it in here. I feel good here.
50 years later, Cicely is now busy preparing for the golden anniversary of that special year with a Summer of Love fashion show. And she's got the merchandise and lived experience to do it right.
Kevin, what's your story with these? Are you getting rid of them? Are you?
Yeah, I got this from a guy down in Palo Alto, and his older brother went to school with Pigpen, and he also had the buffalo jacket Pigpen used to wear.
So sweet of you to pursue that for me. Okay, that's the
shop's incredible.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kevin's going to loan these to me for the Summer of Love fashion show that's belonged to Pigpen from Grateful Dead.
Oh, cool.
And this is a great shirt.
Work in Progress is an original series from Slack. Slack is where work happens, at places like Milken Community Schools in Los Angeles. More on them at the end of the show. Check us out at slack.com/podcast or tweet us at Slack Stories. A minute ago, we met Cicely Hansen, proprietor of Decades of Fashion. Her store is rooted in her love of vintage fashion and her formative years as a teenager in the 60s. Listening to Cicely, you get the sense that it's not just about the clothes themselves, it's about the spirit behind the clothes. And it's about how so much of your identity is wrapped up in how you present yourself to the world. Cicely's clothes are functional, of course, but they're also an outward expression of her values, what she believes in. Now, our next story, it's not about clothes at all, but it is about fighting for what you believe in. And like Cicely's story, it's rooted in the counterculture of the 60s.
Hey there.
How's it going?
How are you? How are things?
Very good, good. How are yourself?
Very good, excellent. This particular strain is working really good for GI problems. This particular sativa versus indica is getting more and more effective against, let's say, muscle spasms.
Welcome to the Apothecarium. It's a hip little joint in the Castro district of San Francisco that you have to be 21 years old or older to enter. You can order items with names like catatonic and gorilla glue. And no, these are not fancy cocktails. They are strains of marijuana. The Apothecarium is a medical cannabis dispensary, one of about 3,000 operating dispensaries in California. One of the men behind it, Dr. Floyd Hewen, is giving us a tour.
Last week, two of my patients, long-time chronic pain, older ladies, had been on Vicodin, Norco, oxycodone. They walked in and triumphantly said, Dr. Hinn, I'm off the opiates completely, and I'm only using the cannabis you recommended. And look at me. And the thing isn't just the physical improvement. It's their mental status. It's sort of like, I never knew this person because they had been so drugged by the opiates. It's unbelievable.
Floyd can't wait to open a second branch of his medical pot service in the Sunset District. He wants the Sunset Apothecarium to cater to the large population of Asian American residents who live there. He's planning to have multilingual staff members, as well as traditional Chinese medicine services, like acupuncture.
I think if I can get people to be more open to new ways of doing things and use both Eastern and Western traditions, that would pretty much say what I am, which is I'm a cross between Eastern and Western. I am myself a combination of China and America. So that also would be my legacy.
But when Floyd attended a community meeting in Sunset to talk about his plans, he encountered something he hadn't expected, a hostile crowd.
You're supposed to be a role model.
I cannot even stand it. Don't talk about using it. It's horrible smell.
I'm not near my children, sorry.
Why do we have to listen to their garbage? No!
Floyd was crushed. He knew there'd be some dissenting voices, there always are, but legal medical marijuana use was so widespread in California. The state had even voted to legalize recreational weed recently. Floyd had come armed with information and success stories that he'd witnessed firsthand, ready for a good discussion, but the people were simply unwilling to hear him. They were angry at the mere notion he'd bring a pot dispensary into their neighborhood. And after decades of trying to make inroads in San Francisco as an Asian American himself, Floyd thought he deserved a bit more respect.
First of all, in all my years of organizing, that's never happened to me before. I've never been shouted down in a meeting. That meeting was hijacked by an organized group of protesters that gave me 1 minute to speak. And when I'm looking in the man's eyes, this immigrant gentleman, maybe a little younger than me probably, and he's saying, you know, evil invaders, you know, et cetera. And I tried to start by saying the first demonstration in San Francisco Chinatown was organized by me from Berkeley, you know. But I didn't get a chance to say that. I felt sad. I felt sad that here I am, I'm actually the exemplar of what many of those parents want their kids to be. UC Berkeley, medical school, make it in American society.
If only that group in the community center had realized that Floyd wasn't so different from them.
I remember seeing the Golden Gate Bridge while I was on board the ship. And to this day, I still remember that.
2-year-old Floyd left China with his family in 1949 to move to San Francisco. They came from a lineage of poor villagers whose fate changed during World War II when his father got an opportunity to cook for and then join the U.S. Navy.
On the ship, on the way over here, my mom is the leader of our family. She asked around, where's the best university? You know, she was that far-sighted, right? And everybody said, UC Berkeley. So she pretty much ordered my dad to be stationed as close as possible to Berkeley so that we could buy a home in Berkeley. And that's exactly what we did.
Floyd was brought up as a model Chinese-American son. He kept up his native Cantonese while learning English at school. He valued family and loved Motown, and in 1965, he fulfilled his mother's wish and gained early admission to UC Berkeley. But what Floyd's mom didn't account for was that this was Berkeley in the 60s.
It began a year ago when the so-called free speech advocates should have been taken to the scruff of the neck and thrown out of the university once and for all.
Operation of the machine becomes so odious that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Back in the 60s, the Berkeley campus was ground zero for student protest. Students fought for the right to speak freely about politics, religion, equal rights, and gender issues. They conducted sit-ins, strikes, and acts of disobedience. Despite being a model son, Floyd couldn't help getting swept up in everything that was happening. Soon, he became part of the activist movement.
See, up until that point, Asian Americans are simply not active politically. You know, all the usual reasons why people would not struggle. Exclusion, expectation from the family to go along and get along, study hard, get a degree, get a good job, contribute to the American dream, and you will get the American dream. And so I think that was the understanding.
By 1968, Floyd was an active member of the Asian American Political Alliance. They joined the Third World Liberation Front student strike, seeking to establish the first ethnic studies departments in America.
During one of the demonstrations, my mother, she walked up to the university with a lunch for me. She walked through the tear gas, you know, and she came in and sat down, and I said, "Mom, what are you doing here?" She said, "Well, I just thought I'd bring you your lunch, and I wanted to make sure you were okay, because we saw it on TV, right, all the activities at the university." And so she said, "I don't mind you doing this, but you got to be careful about those people." And I would say, "Mom, what people?" She said, "You know, the leaders. You don't know what this is about. Maybe they're leading in a direction that you don't want." And then I finally told her, I said, "Mom, I am those people. I'm in the leadership of this."
The strike succeeded. Berkeley became the first university in America to establish an ethnic studies department, which included programs in African American studies and Asian American studies. By doing so, the dialogue about diverse Americans started to shift.
We were called Orientos at that time. You know, we didn't like that. We rejected that. It was a moniker. It's just like Negro versus Black or Mexican versus Chicano, right? We wanted to choose a term that we determined rather than the larger societies, and we called ourselves Asian Americans.
Floyd married his college sweetheart and fellow activist, Jean Kwan. Together, they went on to become pillars of the Bay Area's Asian American community. Jean became mayor of Oakland, and both of them got behind public housing causes and after-school programs for disadvantaged youth.
I love change. That's what I'm about. Me and my wife are both movement people, right? We want to look for challenges and look to make a difference, not just join and do whatever it's already doing there. We hate conventional wisdom. We're always questioning it.
At the same time, Floyd established himself in the medical community, just as his parents always wanted.
That made them happy. And when I became a doctor and medical director at a hospital, even happier. But probably for a moment there, they weren't quite sure.
But let's go back to that night in the Sunset District, last spring, when Floyd came to discuss the medical cannabis dispensary he wanted to open and was met with anger and insults.
So that's why I said my response is sadness, not anger. And I think that actually looking back on it, that the reason that happened is that we've been effective. Myself and my wife have been very effective with Chinese Americans, explaining what we're doing and getting their support. And so the only way to stop that is to simply stop us from doing it. We have to be patient about it, and it's going to take people time. I mean, look, in PRC, People's Republic of China, it's a crime still, right? Well, they're ignorant. I'm sorry. The science is the science.
Despite being an activist from the 60s, Floyd was far from a stoner. In fact, to this day, it's not really his thing.
We would drink a little wine every now and then, but we were not. We were more serious political people. But many of our friends smoke weed in the evening to relax instead of wine. And I would always justify it by saying, well, every time you drink a cup of wine, you're killing brain cells. So no problem, you know, if you want to just smoke a joint instead.
But Floyd became convinced of weed's medicinal properties in the early 80s, when more and more people walked into his clinic with mysterious tumors and rare cases of pneumonia.
What the hell is this? You know, these guys are really sick. We would take blood tests, the white counts would be really low, CD4 count was really bad. What the heck is this?
It turned out to be the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in America.
I didn't have anything in my training to prepare me for this. This is brand new.
Patients would stop eating and were literally wasting away. After conversations with several people in the HIV/AIDS community, Floyd learned that some patients were using marijuana to boost their appetites.
The stress that they were under, their whole demeanor was different. Their appetite became better. And it was like a godsend. It was really amazing. There was nothing else that worked as well.
Remember, this is the 80s, and marijuana was very illegal at the time. Floyd didn't care. One of the many things he learned by living through the 60s is that some rules are meant to be broken.
We had to say to the patient, have your friends bring it in. We'll look a blind eye to it and just use it. I don't care. Just do it, because otherwise you're going to die.
Somehow, Floyd managed to treat patients this way for several years without getting caught. Then, in 1996, California legalized the use of medical marijuana. Floyd could now legally recommend the use of marijuana for medical purposes. But he faced a new challenge.
I had a dying patient, and I said, here's my choice. IV morphine, which would completely knock her out, or cannabis. I said cannabis. Up until that point, when you use IV morphine, they're out of it completely. They're comfortable, but they're out of it. But where do we get it, right? So my wife asked me, so what are you going to do, ask her to go to a park?
Floyd could recommend the use of medical marijuana, but how did he know the products his patients used were safe and tested? The answer to his dilemma led to the collaboration with the Apothecarium. Now Floyd had peace of mind. The products his dispensary sells have literally passed the test.
Life isn't completely planned. You respond to opportunities. And the Chinese word for crisis also has opportunity in it. And that's exactly the way I see these things. And as long as it's good for patients, that's ultimately what I will do.
70-year-old Floyd is still on his mission, hoping to convince the Sunset community to hold another meeting so that he can try once again to convince people that his dispensary is nothing to be afraid of.
The number one rule of organizing is to listen to the needs of the people you're working with. They're so whipped up about this issue that we're going to bring cannabis that will addict their kids. Look at the data. Look at what happened in Colorado. Look at what happened in Washington. Right? Youth usage didn't go up. In fact, in many cases, it went down. You can't walk into the Apothecarium and get a prescription. You need a doctor's referral, and you have to be over 21 for recreational. So it's just not going to happen.
What the members of the Sunset community don't realize is that Floyd isn't someone to give up easily. Through his experience dealing with all the different kinds of cultural shifts in his life, Floyd's created his own definition of the model citizen.
The way I was raised is to be humble, to be helpful to people, and not be a tyrant. I'm pretty mild-mannered, but when I'm at a picket line or if I'm giving a talk about some outrage, I'm not mild-mannered at all. I'm a Boy Scout from way back. I still use the Scout model. I still live by that. Loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. And I'm all of those things.
On October 3rd, after this episode was produced, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted to uphold an appeal blocking the Apothecarium's Sunset location from opening. It was the result of ongoing neighborhood protest. Legal recreational cannabis sale begins on January 1st, 2018, and when that happens, the board will have to decide how to issue dispensary permits going forward, which may open the doors to the Sunset once again. Work in Progress is an original series from Slack. Slack is where work happens, at places like Milken Community Schools. Here's how they use Slack.
My name is Gabriel Yanai, and I am a senior at Milken Community Schools in Los Angeles, California. I am the electronics sub-team captain on my school's first robotics competition team, number 1836, the Milken Knights. First Robotics Competition, or FRC, is a global competition with thousands of high school teams. We learn industry-standard skills, all while having fun and inspiring youth to pursue STEM fields. Prior to using Slack, it was really hard to get everyone on the same page. We work long days, but not everyone can make it to every meeting or stay the entire time. We use Slack to have discussions, conduct votes, and share progress updates. We also assign tasks and organize part orders. At competitions, we have dedicated Slack channels for logistics, planning, and strategy. Our team operates smoothly and much more efficiently thanks to Slack.
To find out more about Slack or to get in touch, visit us. We're at slack.com/podcast or tweet us @SlackStories. I'm Dan Meisner. Thanks for listening.